And the battle of words made its way into Israeli textbooks this week, too. The Israeli Ministry of Education has banned reference to the Arabic word Nakba from Arabic language Israeli textbooks. The word Nakba means the catastrophe, and it resonates for millions of Palestinians. It's the word that they use to describe the creation of the State of Israel when millions of Palestinians became refugees at the end of the 1948 war. Boutros Mansour is general director of the Nazareth Baptist School. That's a school in Israel for Israeli Arabs where the textbooks in question are used. And he joins us from his home in Nazareth. Mr. Mansour, what's your reaction to the Education Ministry's decision?
I think this decision has no basis, not historical, because I think in other countries, when governments wanted to just ignore the suffering of another people in a time of conflict, this didn't work. I think it's contradictory to the right of speech, and I also think it's not practical in the world that we live in today, which is a flood of information and internet. So this is an absurd decision. I hope they rethink it, or maybe somebody can appeal to the High Court and change that according to the Israeli constitutional law.
Now, as I understand it, the Ministry of Education is reversing an action taken by the previous Ministry of Education just 2 years ago, when that ministry, a member of the Labour Party, inserted this statement into a primary school text for Arab-Israeli students. The Arabs call the war the Nakba, a war of catastrophe, loss, and humiliation, and the Jews call it the Independence War, or the War of Independence. Does that statement in a history text strike you as principal of an Israeli Arab school? Does it strike you as a fair way of teaching what people think about that war?
The 2007 decision, I think, is an open-minded decision. A person who studies history should not be from one side. There are two sides to a coin, and I think it should be obvious that the independence of Israel came on the expense of another people who have still until today, 6 decades after that, are still suffering from it. So I think that decision was more knowledgeable one.
Here, though, is the rationale of the current Israeli education minister, who is of the right-wing Likud party. He says you cannot expect any country to describe its own founding as a catastrophe. If someday there's a Palestinian state, we wouldn't expect it to go on at length about the setback it dealt to Israeli settlers in the West Bank when it was created.
I understand the rationale, but I'm not saying that it should emphasize the Nakba, but at least try to give a balanced observation of what happened in 1948.
Now, in the Israeli system, are you obliged to use a text that doesn't have that paragraph in it, or to not use the text that does have that paragraph in it?
We're not free to use our own text. Our school is called the Christian Private School, but we're obliged to use the Israeli curriculum. So you can't just ignore the other side of the story. Maybe teachers will be teaching that, but asking the students to answer the questions in the exams in a way that will please maybe the government, but that will be very, very odd also. I don't know how we're going to deal with it.
Mr. Mansour, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Boutros Mansour is general director of the Nazareth Baptist School. That is a school in Israel for Arab students. We also tried to contact the Israeli Ministry of Education, and we received no response to our call.
Los Angeles-based actor-director Patrick O'Sullivan spent a good part of his young life impersonating this actor.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
That's Christopher Walken appearing on Saturday Night Live. Patrick O'Sullivan turned his impersonation of Walken into a successful stage show that lasted 2.5 years. Now he's back, but with a new muse. NPR's Shereen Meraji reports.
I dare you to put on some shades and try impersonating this guy.
You can't handle the truth!
Truth is, it's not easy to copy Jack Nicholson, even if you're Patrick O'Sullivan. But that didn't stop him from trying. His first show, All About Walken, was a labor of convenience.
That happened because me and so many of my friends were impersonating Christopher Walken.
But his latest effort is a pure labor of love.
Jack show happened because he is my favorite actor.
In All About Jack, you'll find parodies of Nicholson's films with added real-life details. For example, the actor's obsession with the L.A. Lakers. Here's Lakers star Kobe Bryant on The Tonight Show.
Sometimes when I'm taking the ball out of bounds, I just hear somebody just completely just cursing the referees out. I mean, he's just laying into them.
Yeah.
And I peek down, and it's Jack, right? Yeah.
And here's O'Sullivan on how he took that and mashed it up with a movie scene for his stage show.
Probably the most overdone Jack impersonation piece or anything. Everybody always does You Can't Handle the Truth from A Few Good Men. We put it into where Jack's yelling at the referee.
Oh, come on, ref, you can't make that call.
You want me to throw you out of here, Nicholson?
You really want me to answer that?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
O'Sullivan finessed his impersonation with the help of fellow cast members, among them William Joseph Hill.
All you do is just drop the voice down a little bit and whisper. But it's hard to whisper on stage because nobody can hear you.
And the only female Jack, Amy Kelly.
It's an impersonation that is best early in the morning. it is, because you wake up and you're a little hoarse. I was asked that of all my prey. It's just a weird yuck. Does it make you feel creepy a little bit?
Ever wonder what Jack Nicholson's version of creepy would have been like in, say, Titanic or Love Actually? Wonder no more. O'Sullivan's impersonators can do it all.
We've come to a part of the show called The Jack-Off.
The audience can suggest movies that Jack Nicholson hasn't done, and we'll do our best to perform them as if he was cast in them.
Another scene, please. Another one.
Lolita.
That would be a documentary on Jack's life.
After the show, in the lobby of the small theater on Sunset Boulevard, audience members chatted about the performance, and one person strolled confidently to the mic to share his thoughts.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. It had a little class to it, it was exciting, and it was about me, so...
So that wasn't really Jack Nicholson, just audience member Mark Halloran getting into the spirit of things. The real Jack hasn't had a chance to see the show. Yet. According to his agent, he's busy working on a new film, playing somebody else. Shireen Meraji, NPR News.
Tomorrow, millions of America's low-wage workers get a raise. The federal minimum wage jumps from $6.55 an hour to $7.25. Congress approved that raise a couple of years ago. Now, some economists worry that higher wages will hurt small business in a recession. Eileen Applebaum says the raise will help working families.
The minimum wage has always and ever, and still today, is a working women's issue. Two-thirds of minimum wage workers today are women.
Applebaum is a Rutgers University economist.
Life is just one crisis after another, and we have children growing up in poverty. There's no other industrialized country with the kinds of poverty that children face in this country.
And that is where NPR's David Green begins, with a child and his mom in New Orleans.
I want you to meet 24-year-old Jamie Clark and her son Edward. They live in a crowded house with five other family members outside New Orleans. Clark is the face of the low-wage worker. She spends her days, many nights, at a downtown restaurant.
Yeah, I'm a server. I do, you know, wait on tables. We also, it's a small restaurant, so we like bus our own tables. We sort of do a little bit of everything.
For a little bit of money. Right now, Clark's boss has to make sure that including tips, she goes home with $6.55 an hour. Tomorrow, Jamie Clark gets a raise. She knows she'll be coming home to her son with at least $7.25 for each hour of effort. It might not seem like much, but up until now, Edward has been getting his clothing, his toys, from neighbors once their kids are done with them.
That's what I'm thinking of in my head. I'm like, oh, $7.25, now I can buy this. And it's just really embarrassing not to be able to provide just those simple things.
She says now she might get Edward one of those Transformer toys he's been begging for.
Being able to buy a toy for my son, that puts money back in the economy.
Money back in the economy. What Clark said right there is actually the subject of a lot of debate right now. Many of these economists, like Eileen Applebaum at Rutgers, believe Jamie Clark is right. If low-wage workers like her have a bit more money to spend, that's good for the economy in a recession. On the other hand,
this is absolutely the worst time to raise the minimum wage.
Many economists, like Richard Burkhauser from Cornell University, worry that increasing the minimum wage will put such a strain on small businesses, they might have to cut some of their low-wage jobs.
It's hard to tell a story that something that everybody thinks helps people doesn't.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
To try to understand this whole debate, let's head now to a place like Ocean City, Maryland. The beach town and its boardwalk lined with pizza and ice cream shops, and also those places where you can get whatever you want pierced. Also teenagers looking for any way to make money. I'm in the Sportland Arcade with Sashi Nawaratnasamy. She's a college student from Sri Lanka working here. You know those machines where you control a crane and you try to pick up a prize? Well, Sashi's job is to take care of them.
Cute teddy bears here.
So is there a secret to this? I mean, I've never been able to make that crane pick anything up.
No, I have no idea about that.
Sashi wants to make $3,000 this summer to take back to college in Minnesota. Tomorrow, her wage goes up from $7 to $7.25 an hour. Sure, it's only 15 bucks more a week.
But can a quarter an hour help? I mean, will that be...
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
You think you'll spend it going extra out to dinner and extra time over the summer, or you'll hold on to it for college?
No, I will hold on to my college because that's why I came here.
But Sashi's bosses are worried about paying out higher wages in such a bad tourism year.
Last year was 10 times busier in Ocean City, and we're just trying to tough it out, and hopefully August brings in the good money.
This is Stephanie Hippler. She and the other managers at the arcade say this year's been so tight, they've already cut 8 summer employees. I'm speaking here to Hippler and also Robin Phillips, the general manager.
Bad timing, definitely, I would say, for us to have to up our payroll.
And so what do you think? How will you handle it? I mean, you might have to cut back on hours.
You cut back on hours and you give, instead of 2 days off, you get 3 days off. So you cut as much as you can.
And just how businesses like this respond to the minimum wage hike is something economists are watching. I'll talk more about this on our program All Things Considered later today. I'm David Greene, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. We begin this hour with the debate over health care. It's getting more intense. President Obama is taking his argument for a health care overhaul to the American people this week. It dominated his news conference last night, and today the president hosted a health care town hall in Cleveland. Back in Washington, though, the fate of an overhaul is as uncertain as ever. We've asked NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner to come in and help sort all these things out for us. And let's begin, Julie, with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He said his chamber definitely will not be voting on health care before it leaves for the August recess. And President Obama now concedes that he won't have that bill on his desk before the break. Is this a surprise?
Well, hardly a surprise. I would more call it a formal recognition of reality. There's two Senate committees working on this. One of them is finished. But the really important committee in the Senate, the Finance Committee, is and has been huddled behind closed doors for more than a month now, trying to hammer out a bipartisan compromise. They say they're making progress, which is probably true, or else they wouldn't be still meeting every day. Senator Reid does say he wants the Finance Committee to finish its work before the August recess. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow. I believe that part is probably doable.
Okay, let's go to the House now. That seemed to be on a faster track in getting its bill voted on, but now not so much?
Not so much. As of now, it's not at all clear what the state of things are in the House. There's three committees there working on a bill. Two are done. The third is stuck because there's enough conservative so-called blue dog Democrats to block a vote. Now, technically, the House doesn't have to wait for that third committee, and there was apparently a very contentious meeting of House Democratic leaders this morning. Here's how House Speaker Nancy Pelosi described it at her weekly news conference.
I invited the views of members in terms of some of the issues and the timing as we go forward, and it was pretty exciting. But there was definitely a sentiment in the meeting that members wanted to get this done before the break.
Julie, why wouldn't the House want to vote before the break?
Well, there's a calculated risk here. There's a big tax increase in the bill for high-income people. House may not want to vote for that if the Senate ends up doing something completely different. On the other hand, if the House doesn't vote, it doesn't look very good from a momentum point of view. That's what the president's been saying about why he set these deadlines in the first place, because the default setting for Congress is inertia, and there's some truth to that.
Okay, well, let's talk about fact-checking and go back to the president's news conference for a moment. Any place there that he overstated his case, Julie?
Well, there's one place in particular where the president's kind of trying to have it both ways. Here's what he said about a health bill and its impact on the deficit.
I've also pledged that health insurance reform will not add to our deficit over the next decade, and I mean it.
Julie, I've heard that a lot lately. Is it not the case?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define deficit and how you define health insurance reform. Turns out there's $245 billion in that bill to help avoid a 20% cut for doctors on Medicare next year. Now, the administration says that they're calling that already baked in, that that was going to happen anyway. So it shouldn't be counted as part of this whole reform plan. On the other hand, that was really what helped get the American Medical Association's endorsement for the bill. So if it hadn't been in this bill, the AMA might well not have endorsed it. So it certainly does add to the deficit according to the Congressional Budget Office. It may not add to the deficit according to the administration or according to the conservative blue dogs who agreed to let them add it in. So you get to judge whether you think it adds to the deficit or not. But the president said he's not going to count it.
Okay. NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, thanks.
You're very welcome.
We're going to continue our international briefing by opening the pages of a new novel about Cuba. It's part of our summer reading series. All summer long, we've been interviewing authors of new works set in summer. And then we ask them to pass on the love by recommending another author to our listeners. We started with Colson Whitehead, who recommended Juno Diaz, who in turn recommended today's guest, Achi Ovejas. Her latest novel is Ruins. It's set in Havana in the summer of 1994. And she's joining us now from Chicago. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate being here.
What inspired the book? How did you start?
I'd finished Days of Awe, my last novel, and then the world sort of collapsed. The book was released in August 2001, and then a month later, in the middle of all this tremendous criticism and reviews and everything, the whole publishing universe obviously was deeply affected by the events in New York. But for me, it was important to sort of just get away from all that, and I went back to Cuba, and I had sort of packed in haste, and I didn't take a lot of books with me. And when I was scouting around the house, I stumbled across a copy of Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. And it's a book that takes place entirely in Cuba. It's the only book of his that takes place entirely in Cuba. It took me back to a fishing village called Cojimar, which is where he lived. But also it was the site of the 1994 exodus in Cuba, where more than like 70,000 people left. And I started talking to people in Cojimar about that exodus. And obviously the people in Cojimar who were telling me the stories about what happened and how it had been to have tens of hundreds of thousands of people leaving from this little village were people who had chosen to stay. So I wanted to write that story. I wanted to write the story about the people who stay.
Usnavi, the name of your protagonist, which is spelled
U-S-N-A.
Navy.
Right.
Navy.
Correct.
Forgive me that I don't know this, but is this a common name? And why did you choose that name? Because as you pointed out, this is set in 1994 at a time when many people are leaving. And the whole point of Usnavi is he doesn't want to leave. He's a true believer. So why did you call it? Is it just to make that connection to the constantly looking out at the sea and the wondering that's
out
there?
Absolutely. And the thing is, he's 54 years old. So he's a pre-revolutionary child. And all of the things that the U.S. embodied for people were things that his mother sort of projected onto him and wanted to give him a name to, you know, reflect that. Because what happened was young mothers looking out at Guantanamo Bay would see these very powerful U.S. Navy ships, and they would name their kids after, you know, what they saw as kind of mighty and majestic. So names become very symbolic in Cuban culture.
There's also a look at homophobia in Cuban society. Reynaldo, the young son of one of Usnavi's friends, is gay, and he ends up leaving and going to America. And we later find out in the book that he gets a sex change and he becomes Reina, and then he returns as a woman. What gave you this idea?
I've always been sort of fascinated by how in Cuba a lot of the discussion about homosexuality is extremely complicated because of a terrible history in Cuba during the 60s, that is, during the revolutionary times when there were labor camps set up for homosexuals. They were called UMAPs. What it's done, it's created this society that's very aware of this terrible history that they never talk about officially. It's not in the history books. No one's ever stepped up and taken responsibility for the UMAPs. No one's ever dealt with it in any way to explain why it happened. And the issue of homosexuality is very present, but it's very present at a kind of a street level.
Let me just jump in briefly just to say, if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with author Achi Ovejas about her latest book. It's called Ruins, and it's set in 1994 in Havana. You know, Ajiv, one of the things that I also, I was impressed by how you got inside the mind of this middle-aged man and all of his kind of his longing and his desire to be a stand-up guy.
I think for me, one thing is that, you know, I had a very tumultuous but very close relationship with my own father. There was a tremendous amount of yearning in his life and a yearning for a return to Cuba, which he never really managed. And so that was, you know, very much informing this character. But I think the other person who was very much informing this character was Miguel Bruguera, who the book is partially dedicated to. Miguel was the father of an ex-girlfriend of mine, someone who participated in the revolution from the very beginning as a teen and died summer of 2006, actually while I was in Havana. And, you know, went to his death very much a believer, a person who would wave the flag if necessary, would take up guns, take up arms to defend Cuba from any American invasion, but who, on the other hand, was experiencing a tremendous crisis of conscience and ethics. And for me, it was a tremendous lesson in sort of watching this extremely dignified man struggle with these things and feeling a certain impotence, but also questioning his life in some very fundamental ways. I mean, the revolution was his life.
Forgive me if it's too personal, but I just wondered, where are you in this story? Often when someone has taken a journey, one's life has taken a journey from this place to that place, sometimes, you know, my body is here, but my heart is there. And you have the ability to travel between worlds. And I'm just wondering, where are you in this story? Are you now at home in both places? Are you never at home? Where are you?
Well, I think I'm both. I think sometimes I'm very much at home in both places, and sometimes I'm not quite at home in either place. In Ruins, I'm not so much in this story. I left Cuba. I left Cuba at 6. It wasn't my decision to leave, so to a certain extent, it gives me a pass. Certainly in Cuba, oftentimes when I'm introduced to someone who lives abroad, it's always curious to me that people will say, oh, this is Achi Obejas. She lives in the States. She was taken by her parents. And that will be the phrase that will be used, se la llevaron. I'm never assigned responsibility for having left. So to me, it's a very interesting and curious point that's always made.
Do people find it strange that you come back so often?
I think at this point, some people do find it strange because I think there are many Cuban Americans who have gone back, certainly, and there are people who go back for a little while, and then life takes them in different directions, and you know they get absorbed and back into, for lack of a better word, their regular life or their real life in the States, and the romance sort of ends, or they find some disappointment, or they get hurt, or whatever.
But I must tell you, that's a story we don't hear very often. The story we hear very often, at least to kind of in the major media narrative, is I'm not going back until Fidel is gone, or I go back to visit my aunties and to bring them some shoes.
Sure.
And that's it, and I'm not going back. I really don't think we hear very much about people who go back.
Yeah, I think it's because what happens is that people go back for a little while, and then they stop going back. Because, for example, the aunties die, and then you don't have to go back anymore. Or, you know, you have a political, you know, falling apart with, you know, Cuba in a variety of different ways. I mean, it can happen, you know. And I think for me, I've been remarkably constant in my relationship with Cuba, if you want to call it that, in part because I want to be a part of Cuba. I know that I cannot reclaim a life that might have been, and I have no interest in that life that might have been. I'm very happy with the life that has been, but I'm interested in this country, and I'm interested in this culture, and not as a tourist and not as an outsider, but as a person who comes from that place. You know, the fact that I was born in Cuba is the most determining factor in my life. It absolutely affects everything in my life. And it's not something that I can change. So I very much embrace this idea of having a relationship with my home country. It's caused a lot of problems. Believe me, my mom to this day is still angry at the idea that I go back. She's one of those people you mentioned who would rather die than go back.
Wow. And finally, for our summer reading series, we are asking the authors we interview to please recommend our next author, hopefully a contemporary one, hopefully something pretty new. So what do you think our listeners should read after they finish your book?
Well, I'm gonna give you two things, and you worry about what you want to do with it, okay? The one that I'm reading right now, this moment, is a book called Santa Evita, and it's by an Argentine writer named Tomás Eloy Martínez. He does live in the States, and it's a book that's a few years old, but I don't think it ever got enough attention. It's a fascinating book about the cult around Eva Perón, and it's written as a novel, in a first-person way, as this character sort of investigating the cult of Evita Perón and all the insanity around Evita Perón, especially the journeys of her body. I don't know if you know this, but she was embalmed this crazy way, and the body spent years being kidnapped and exhibited and hidden, and you couldn't make this stuff up.
Well, you could. I mean, you're a writer.
Yeah,
but...
Oh, my God. It's just madness.
Okay, what's the other?
It's really... And, of course, the other one is Love and Obstacles by Alexander Heman, another Chicago writer. But I find Sasha's work to be just stunning. What he does with language, how he constructs a story, all of that to me is just mind-boggling and fantastic. And I'm constantly tipping my hat to him.
Achi Ovejas, her latest book is Ruins, and she was kind enough to join us from Chicago. Achi Ovejas, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And you can read an excerpt from Ruins and learn more about Achi Ovejas' other literary favorites by logging onto our website. Go to npr.org and click on Tell Me More.
This week's stop in our series on farmers' markets is Brentwood, California. Rachel Miro of member station KQED tempts us with the most unlikely of fruits, figs.
A whoosh of wind rushes through the eucalyptus lining Knoll Farms. Rick Knoll and his wife sell at local farmers' markets, grocery stores, and restaurants. Knoll says he grows at least 7 varieties of fig.
Brown Turkey, Black Mission, Cadota, Adriatic, Latarula, Blackjack, and then we have a couple of our own. They're hybrids of all the other ones. So they might look like a brown turkey on the outside, but they might look like an Adriatic on the inside. They might sugar up like a Cadota, something like that.
These aren't the shriveled, leathery sad sacks you find crammed into plastic baskets. No, figs are fat, green and purple golf balls on steroids, and they come to market ripe, oozing nectar from the flower end.
They're the sexiest thing there is.
Which leads the farmer in short order to the Bible.
It wasn't an apple that got him kicked out of the garden. It was figs.
As long as we're talking about sin, Noel says they cure hangovers too.
Get a little too drunk and then eat 3 figs in the morning and you snap right out of it.
Noel was contemplating this cure while sipping beer at a party on his farm. A half dozen local restaurant chefs showed up recently to help him celebrate 30 years in the food business. At first, most chefs protest that fresh figs should be eaten as is. But after a pause, preparations come to mind. Stuart Briozas requires a hot grill.
Porchetta. It's loin and belly, the entire mid-range of the pig, boned out, rolled up with grilled figs, rosemary, and garlic. And then we'll baste it with the remainder of it on the outside as it cooks.
While they're in season, clothing designer Michelle Tannenbaum buys 4 to 5 pounds of the fruit a week, all for herself.
Bring them home in egg cartons so they don't rub together and get all bruised. I love them in salads with goat cheese on them, and then a piece of basil leaf. Sometimes I'll even drizzle a little balsamic on there, cut them in quarters and wrap prosciutto around the fig.
But a lot of the time, she says, she can't wait. She just starts eating them. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
You can find more on figs and share your fig recipes at npr.org.